Here on Surfing the Quicksand, I spend a lot of time talking about individuals and what we as individuals might want to think about or do or know about, especially as it relates to menopause and perimenopause. But today, we're going to shift the focus a little bit and talk about the workplace. And as a former HR person, it's something that's been on my mind a lot because I don't think we really talked about it much when I was focused every day on the workforce in front of me. And today I'm talking to somebody who has done nothing but think about menopause in the workplace. I'm Kathy Vines. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. As we are all familiar, perimenopause and menopause is more than just a physiological body event. It's also impacting our brains and our emotions and the way we relate to people on almost every level. And that's not just in our own lives at home, but in the workplace too. My guest today is Dr. Susan Mealy, and like me, she is a recovering HR professional. She has been turning her passions and talents and time and energy to helping improve lives in a broader scale, helping to normalize menopause in the workplace. As a former chief people officer and executive, she is shouting from the rooftops to help organizations understand that menopause is not just an individual issue, but it impacts workplace culture, inclusion, and retention of senior women. What I want to talk with her today is her insights about what she's learned from her long personal and professional experience with menopause in the workplace, and what she's been doing to try and help drive changes in workplace culture, policies, and practices from this side of the consulting arm. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, Kathy. It's great to be here.
Thank you. I want to start with helping people understand your story. As I said, it's personal and professional. And I think your story is a little unique that most people who are going through perimenopause or menopause may not identify with. So let's start with that.
Sure. So you mentioned my HR career. I spent 38 years in HR, but they're really two different chapters. And the delineation really is around my perimenopausal experience. So I was only 42, so this was a little more than 20 years ago. I had reached the C-suite in my late 30s. I was super ambitious and worked for high growth, high change companies in the Boston area. So had worked my way up the corporate ladder after putting myself through college and really loved the work and was pretty good at it. I think I got better at it actually after my humbling experience. But I had my daughter at 37, so she was 5 years old, and I started getting very severe psychological symptoms, cognitive misfiring, really. I couldn't finish a sentence. I was really anxious, really irritable. I was forgetful. I was having trouble sleeping, but I think it was more because I was worked up. I had no typical symptoms of menopause. This was also the early 2000s, so the WHI study that is pretty well known now about menopausal hormonal therapy had largely impacted menopause in a negative way. That hormone therapy was taken off the market. Women were told they pretty much just had to suffer through menopause for couple more decades after that. So even my age was probably my age and my symptoms were very deceiving. And then it was just easy for doctors to say, well, you have a very stressful job and you have a very busy life and it's got to be burnout or it's stress or it's anxiety or it's depression. It was just like a very easy way to send me away with a prescription. But the symptoms were severe and came very quickly. So perimenopause can be very sneaky. It can start anywhere from 4 to 10 years before your last period. And it is by definition the irregular functioning of your hormones are be very erratic And that's what makes perimenopause really tricky because no two women experience menopause the same way. So my hormones were clearly erratic, but it was all neurological. So my estrogen receptors in my brain must have been what were most impacted by the hormone fluctuation. So I didn't have anything that I could describe as normal menopausal symptoms. So I was desperate. My performance was suffering, my marriage was suffering, and clearly my sanity was suffering. And I resigned at 42. What arguably at that point was the peak of my career. I had worked so hard. It was a great job. It was a Fortune 500 company that I probably could still be at if I hadn't so abruptly and desperately left. I didn't really even have a good story. I remember telling my boss I needed to take a break. And I was like, my father worked in a shipyard. I grew up in a lower middle class, blue collar part of Boston. I was like, my dad. Oh, God rest his soul, was like, break? What do you mean? What are you talking about? You're going to lose your house. And I was like, oh, no, we're going to sell the house. Like, we can't afford the house without my income. We're going to sell the house and blah, blah, blah. So,
So this was a that was a big decision then. It wasn't just I'm going to take a break. This was a life-altering decision.
yes, so we had, and because my husband was equally desperate, like, I've spent a lot of time over the last 2 years speaking to workplaces, and a lot of times the men are the ones who are like, I just want to figure out how to help my wife. Like, it's really, we underestimate, or we don't talk about, or it's too stigmatized, the impact that perimenopause and menopause have on relationships. So you started out the conversation with a little bit of that, but for so long, menopause has been reduced to like your last period, your cessation of your ovarian function. No longer are you able to have children, and your reproductive capacity is over. And like that's it. But it is estrogen receptors are everywhere in your body. So your symptoms can range from debilitating psychological symptoms that I had to heart palpitations to incredibly dry skin, you're like wake up in the middle of the night and you're like your arms are bleeding because you were itching unconsciously, to ringing in your ears. Like there's 34 identifiable symptoms of perimenopause, and like I said, it's typically very sneaky. But for some people, severe onset perimenopause is not so sneaky. It comes really fast, really hard. And then within 6 months after my resignation, my doctor was like, "When did you have your last period?" And I was like, "I don't know. I was busy having a breakdown, quitting my job, and trying to figure out what I was going to do next." And she's like, "Well, but still the dots weren't connected because the psychological symptoms and the estrogen's impact on the brain hasn't been, even today, 20 years later, hasn't been that well studied. Although there are studies now, and there's a book called The Menopause Brain, which is excellent. And it's really validating for women whose symptoms are highly psychological to read The Menopause Brain, because it's like, oh my God, I'm not crazy. Because you feel embarrassed if you can't finish a sentence. It's not, it's and it's again, it gets minimized to, oh, I can't remember my keys. It's way worse than that. It's like I can't finish a thought. Like the defining moment that when I decided that I needed to resign, was I was presenting in front of my executive team colleagues. They were 90% men. It was a financial technology company. They were mostly older than me. Back then, I was the younger one all the time. And I couldn't answer a question. And it was about employee engagement, which is one of my favorite subjects as an HR person. And I knew the data, and I couldn't answer the question. Like I couldn't come up with any words. I burst into tears. I ran to the bathroom and I thought, okay, this is it. I can't go back. I can't go face them. So that I went home. My husband and I had already been talking about like, what are we gonna do? Like, we gotta figure this out or else who knows what's gonna happen. And I went to see my good friend who was one of the other executive team members, and I said, I'm going to resign. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, no, I am, like right now. I went down, got a cup of tea, went to see my boss, and said, I need to leave. And he's like, is this about yesterday? And I was like, sort of,
Yeah.
but I think I need to take a break. I don't know. I know my performance is suffering. I know that my life is suffering. I don't know how to fix it. And I can't, like, I couldn't risk any more professional embarrassment after working so hard. And I naively thought, oh, I'll just get this back on track, right? I drastically underestimated the consequences of resigning without a plan. I in 2006. I mean, so it's a little different now, but then I was like, what's my story? Like, how do I get back to work? How do I get back to the C-suite? Oh, I went through menopause, and they'd be like, wow, you're older than you look. B, I had a breakdown. Oh, thanks. Nice to meet you. So it took me 7 years to get back to the C-suite, and it was very circuitous, a little messy. And I'm grateful for the opportunities I had during that time, but it also had a huge financial impact. I mean, when I went back to work a year later, I was making well less than half of what I had made as an executive. And I loved that job. I was a consultant, and I stayed in that role for 4 years at a small boutique consulting firm, and I really enjoyed it. But I thought, gosh, I had worked so hard to get to the C level. I had to find a way back. And it was not easy, but eventually I did find my way back. And I stepped back in a fairly low risk C-level job because it was a startup that was venture backed. And it was now, it would have been, gosh, 7 years later. So it would have been, it doesn't matter, 2014, something like that. And I was like, all right, if this doesn't work, it's pretty low risk kind of situation. Small team. First, it was just me. Then I had to build the team. And then it was unclear whether this product would be successful or not. And it wasn't, but it gave me like good 2 years of like being back in the C-suite in a total different environment, getting the board experience and the venture-backed experience. So then that sort of defined the beginning of my second chapter as a C-suite executive, as a CPO. And the sec that the next 12 years or so were very rewarding. And I had learned so much during that time of exploration of like possible selves, if you will, the way that my first 20 years had been very performative, you know, very ambitious, very much moving, wanting to move to the next step and get the next more important C role. Whereas this chapter I left a couple of years ago was much more about helping build and develop high performing teams and people and connecting the HR strategy to the business strategy and being able to see the impact. So in many ways, you know, what's the expression, right? Things happen for a reason. I feel like I learned a lot during that 7 years that helped me be a much better executive that the last 12 years or so of my career. And then I pivoted and have been doing this kind of work now, gosh, 2.5 years.
So tell me about that. Tell me about what the pivot really is and what was behind it.
So when I left, anyone who's listening who's in human resources probably can relate to this. You get to a certain point where you're like, God, I just don't care about this anymore. Like,
Yes.
and then you dial it in and last as long as you're going to last, or you say, okay, I gotta go. I gotta go find something else. And at that point, our daughter was launched. She was out of grad school. She was working. My husband's career has been a little bit all over the place, and he was looking to do something new. And so I thought, well, this is a time. It was like I had helped build a team, helped take a company public, and the next phase of work was talent management, performance management. And I sat down with my boss and I said, that's like amazing for someone else. That is an amazing opportunity for someone else. And she was wonderful. She totally got it. We agreed I would help find a replacement. And so when I, around that time, 3, 4 years ago, perimenopause and menopause were sort of making a comeback in social media, mainstream media, the Wall Street, the New York Times article, bookstores. And I was like, you know, it had taken me a decade to figure out that I didn't resign due to stress and then go through early menopause, that they were actually the same thing. So I was curious, even though ironically, I knew as a C-level person myself, we weren't talking about menopause at work at the end of my career. But I sort of blame that on like the company I worked for was like bootstrapped, young executives, going public was a priority, that I was like probably the old, the average age was probably closer to 38. So, demographics make a difference when, you're a former benefits person, how do benefits get decided? What's happening in the industry? What's the pressure from inside the company? What can we afford? How progressive do we want to be? Do we want to be on the edge? So I was like, it was never the right moment. And I thought that was my story to myself. Never the right moment in my career that menopause made sense. But then I was talking to some of my friends that are benefit brokers, and I was like, so what is happening in the world of menopause, right? It's happening all around work. Every influencer, all these doctors who have become influencers, the resurgence. The good news is a lot of these influencers have brought attention to it, but they're also bringing fear, which that's one of the reasons I decided to get into this, was to be like a normal, accessible person who's not trying to sell you a supplement that I created. And to use the workplace angle to help people in the workplace specifically to avoid the sort of fate that I found myself in. Now, I'm one of 12% of people that go through menopause before 45, but we're aging as a society. 30% of our workforce is in some stage of menopause right now. So when I say this is a workplace issue, it's a society issue that women over 50 are one of the fastest growing age gender segments of our workforce. So it's like, this is not an individual women's issue. So I start talking to my benefit friends, and they're like, oh yeah, nothing. Nothing's happening. There are no benefits for menopause. And I'm like, no, there are. But there's so, and the UK was leading the way on creating menopause-friendly policies and covering hormone therapy and things like that. So it was starting a couple of years ago here in the United States, but still today, only 10% of companies in the United States have any kind of menopausal benefit. It's probably closer to 6 or 7%. So I thought, well, I can help companies. I always loved my career in HR, incredible from a people perspective. I have a story. I have an academic background as a PhD. I can help bring the information to companies to just normalize. I have one simple mission: normalize the conversation around menopause in the workplace. I'm not trying to get anybody to buy anything. I'm not trying to convince people that they need hormone therapy or else. I'm not selling any other people's products on turmeric and protein. And my message is my work, and it feels really good. So I've been doing this now. I've probably, gosh, I don't even know how many companies I've had the privilege of talking with, but every time I help at least one person, and sometimes more than that. And that's why I've been doing it, because it's complicated. And even the fact that no two women experience menopause the same, people go, wow, really? Huh. Now, common sense says, yeah, that's true, but like you don't really understand that. And the 4 to 10 years, and the other big aha moment people often have is like, okay, so I had my last period. It's been a year. I went through menopause, and I'm like, yes. So now you're in postmenopause. And guess what? That lasts for the rest of your life. It is not to be ignored, especially the first couple of years after you have your last period. So it's like, oh, wait, I thought that was it. I thought that perimenopause, hell, then that last period, which sometimes can be awful for people, like physiologically awful. I thought that was it. I'm like, no, nope. Because
No.
then your hormones, first they're erratic, then they deplete, then your ovarian function stops, and then they disappear largely. So how you deal with that phase when they're gone or going and eventually gone is almost as important as everything else, but it doesn't get the right kind of attention. And
One of the things that's coming to mind to me as you're talking about this, and again, I'm kind of channeling my 20 years in HR, is that as there ends up being kind of a groundswell of attention around factors that impact individuals and then impact the workplace. You think about maternity benefits, right? Like, oh, this is a health insurance issue. No, actually, yes, we address it on that level. And then we say, should we be doing something else to help women be pregnant in the workplace and help women come back from birth in the workplace? Not to mention other parents who didn't give birth. Aren't we support Can't we support that? Because we think as a company, there's value to us in supporting our workforce in that way. Another one that comes to mind is neurodivergency in the workplace, right? And I think there's a ton of work to do on that, but it goes from, oh, gee, how do we support someone as an individual with kind of an adult ADHD diagnosis or working through an autism diagnosis, then how do we help them be a better performer in the workplace? And then it's, no, how do we as an organization learn to embrace that neurodiversity is likely a part of a successful workforce and a diverse workforce? And so it feels like another one in that flavor. We're like, listen, this is, yes, we can talk it about at a benefits level. Are you getting HRT covered? Do you have a flexible PTO policy? Whatever those things are that might come up with, like, let's help the individual with the experience. But then it gets broader of saying, as you said, at any given time, 30% of the workforce is currently experiencing one of the stages of menopause, or thinking about the ways in which a culture is enriched through having a diverse set of women of different ages in the workforce, and that's going to open you up to just the nature of, hey, menopause is on board here.
Right. It's an inclusion issue, just like any other inclusion issue, to your point. And one in three women consider leaving or leave the workforce due to menopausal symptoms. And the first question I often get, why don't we talk about menopause in the workplace? And I'm like, well, three reasons that I think are probably the top three based on my work. One is discrimination. Women already face discrimination in pay, promotion, and representation at the C-level without adding menopause to the conversation. So, one, discrimination. Two, misinformation. It's not a big deal, just a few hot flashes. It's the same for everyone. So, it's not understood. So, like, if you're me and you're having a breakdown, nobody's like, oh, that's menopause. She just needs to take a leave of absence and go, in my case, I needed hormone therapy and it was life-saving. That's not the case for everybody. So misinformation. And then lastly is stigma, right? Menopause equals old, irrelevant, emotional, whatever the stigma. It's your grandmother's kind of illness. Like it's not happening to us. And I think even women slightly younger than me are like, oh God, I don't want this to be happening to me. Like this is happening to me and I'm not even 50. Ew. Like they don't want to talk about it, or they don't want to sort of understand it. They want to just be like, or they're really busy and they have little kids and they have a big job and they have aging parents that they're taking care of. And they're like, really? This isn't just going to be like my last period, check a box, move on to this next phase of my life, which I get frustrated with when it's like this only positioned as like liberation, like the post-menopause is like all liberation. And it's like, nope, it's not that easy. Like, not everybody goes through menopause and comes out the other side with a FU to, I'm now liberated from the confines of having my period or whatever. I'm in my 50s. It's loss and it's liberation. It's like loss and gain. So I feel like understanding the reasons that it isn't often spoken about and trying to just educate people around it is already like 80%. Like, because your point is, I think, very well taken to me. Like at first, when I was starting out my business, helping companies, I was like, oh, I can help them with their benefits. I can help them with that. But you know what? They don't really need help with that. It's not that complicated, right? Just add menopause as a class of within your inclusion frameworks. Add menopause as a reason you can get an accommodation for working adjusted hours or a workplace accommodation, like you get to sit near the window or in a room that happens to be cooler or near the bathroom, or if you work in a lab where you have a uniform that you get to take more regular breaks. Like, and then lastly, menopause specialists and hormone therapy and the benefits. Like, so companies really don't need help. They just need help bringing the conversation and educating the workforce and helping people just talk about it. And I just did a talk at a company, what's today? It doesn't matter, Tuesday. And it was an on-site, which is always a pleasure these days to be on-site. And so we had about 60 people. It's about a 1,000-person company. And the feedback that they got afterward, it wasn't even, the talk was great. The head of the CPO moderated. And so it was a really nice conversation between the two of us. And people were just like, thank you so much to the ERG that sponsored it, to the HR team that coordinated it. It was just like, it's so good to work for a company that's talking about this. And as I said, I've found that lots of men are pretty interested because they're like, oh, my wife is suffering. Like, what can she do?
You know,
And there's lots
it's
of
I want to go back because you mentioned ERG, and for somebody who doesn't know, that's an employee resource group, right? So sometimes they're called affinity groups, but they're kind of focus groups within a workplace meant to bring attention towards issues and development around a particular profile of person. So it might be women, it might be LGBTQIA groups, it might be minority groups, whatever. I present at your family in the workplace groups and things like that. So it's interesting we say, I'm wondering, are the when an ERG is bringing you in, is it usually women? Because what I heard you say is the men want to understand, or men are getting exposed to it too. Tell me about that. When you're coming into an organization, are you talking to women and men?
I am talking to women and men. So I have been invited in with one exception, that there is in a much larger company, I spoke to a menopause affinity group within the
Oh.
women's group. So that was all women. Most of the times, the employee resource groups invite the company. They have been mostly women, women's groups. And then they invite the company to participate in the session. So that has given me the opportunity to meet and speak with men, as well as some of the HR sessions that I've done, like the little HR groups like NERA and things. I haven't spoken at NERA, but I live in Portland, Maine. We have our equivalent here in Maine. So I've done a couple of those as well. So I've had the opportunity. And then the other way I've been invited in is wellness conversations as part of like open enrollment week. There's like a wellness week of topics, and I've had the opportunity to be in front of the whole company, men and women, when it comes in through the wellness programming as well.
So what are you
My
hearing from the men?
mostly concerned about their wives or their mothers or their sisters. It's not just their wives, but that's been the aha moment for several men and several. I publish a lot on LinkedIn, and I have a Substack, and lots of my former male colleagues have reached out to me over like asking for resources or inviting me to conversations. So it's been really, I think it's been great. It's been great for men to be like, I think that taking it out of just a bodily function makes it easier to talk about. Like, if we just think about it as something that happens to our whole self, to our brains, to our relationships, to our psychological ability to communicate, like, if we think about it not just as a function of our fertility, it makes it easier. It's like that you were saying about neurodiverse colleagues. And it's like, I was doing a session last week. Menopause Awareness Month was in October, so I typically am pretty busy this time of year. And one of the men in that group was asking me, like, why I get so, he's like, he gets like, it's his own uncomfortableness. I'm like, well, if you were talking to someone about mental health, what would you do? And he's like, oh, I would just ask them like how they're doing. I'm like, oh, why don't you start there?
Here's an
Don't
idea. Yeah.
you just start with, so how are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, you seem like you're struggling. Like, what's going on? They may or may not tell you, but if you don't ask, I mean, you don't have to go right to menopause, right? Like, oh, are you in menopause? Like, that's crazy. You don't make that assumption about a neurodiverse person. You don't make that assumption about someone who's trying to get pregnant, or you don't make that assumption about mental health issues, right? You ask questions, like treat it like any other inclusion issue. And yeah, of course. Okay, so we need to get better at that as a society, as a group of managers. Like, we need to train people better in how to have difficult conversations, or not even difficult, but delicate conversations. So, but it doesn't have to be specific to menopause. I think that makes people go, all oh, right, okay, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about the discrimination comment, right? So discrimination is already such a significant issue in the workplace for women, for lots of people, but specifically for women. And, and I think about, again, if I were to put on my HR hat on, people would say, like, well, I can't ask them. I can't ask my employee who's a woman who actually hasn't been performing so great lately and her attendance has been off. And I don't know that she's paying attention so much, or she's, I'm having to follow up with her a lot. Her performance has really shifted over time. I'm thinking about that conversation with a manager and how to coach that manager, which, by the way, in this case, I'm assuming is a man because they would find all of this indescribable. But like, how do you talk about that when you're working with organizations about how to be effective managers and leaders while this is around in a performance issue?
I haven't done any specific training on that. There is a lot of really good training available, so I decided not to build any myself. But there is an organization here in the US called Madovia, and they do workplace training, like half hour e-learning sessions. The Menopause Society has a like a downloadable toolkit for HR to share with managers on how to navigate tricky conversations. But I do think it's more like the responsibility of the HR in general to help people navigating conversations. Now, these are specifics around perhaps being a little more sensitive to what you might be saying to someone around menopause and understanding the complexity of it. But it's sort of the umbrella is let's help people be able to treat people like they're humans and then like give people some information so that they're not stepping in it when they're having a one-on-one. But all of the things you said, like those are all things that those could be anything that could be any reason that that person's having that problem. One of them could be menopause. Another could be some kind of personal, like death in the family or divorce or illness, right? There's any number of reasons when the things you just described that people could be experiencing their performance, they're not paying attention, they're having trouble concentrating. Menopause and like trauma move through our body in eerily similar ways because they start with this disruption of your hormones and your brain and how you're firing. And so I think that there are definitely some really good resources to give some people specifics to like avoid saying like you're old or whatever. Those things are you want to
Is
no
it
longer.
time to put you out in the pasture? I'm just checking the clock. You seem to be about that
Wow,
age. Yeah.
I didn't think you were that old. I was like,
Right.
I think
Right.
you're old,
Yeah.
but
Good.
that
And
old. It's
I'm going to gather
like,
those. I'm going to gather some of those resources from
yeah,
you, and
great.
make sure we'll put those in the show notes too, because you've mentioned a whole bunch, and so I want to make sure that we're going to get those out to people. You started to talk about I'd be interested. You started to talk about kind of menopause and trauma in a very kind of similar way. Can you share more about that? That's not a conversation I feel like I've had.
Yeah, so it's like I said, we think menopause just happens to our reproductive functioning, but it happens all to all of us. So when any one of us experiences trauma or loss or grief, right, our brain's like tries to protect itself, and it changes shape, it reshapes in response to trying to protect itself from what's happening. And That's the same exact thing that happens in grief and trauma and menopause. And that's part of what happens in the dysregulation of your hormones. And when you're going through trauma and grief, et cetera, you're also dysregulated. So then that impacts everything else, right? It impacts how you sleep, it impacts your metabolism, it impacts how you see the world, sometimes how the world sees you. It then how and then all the sort of pile on of that, right? So people think women gain weight in menopause. And a lot of women do gain weight in menopause. And your metabolism does slow down. That's more of an aging thing. One of the reasons women gain weight in menopause is because their systems are overwhelmed. They can't sleep, so they're not getting up and going for their morning walks. They're not making the healthiest choices because they're stressed out and they're drinking a lot of coffee and eating a lot of sugar just to get through the day. So and again, same with grief, same with loss, same with trauma. Like your response to it is similar, and it takes over your body, all of your body, and your very sense of self, which is we were talking about when we talked our first conversation about identity and how menopause can impact your identity. And it can do that in many ways. You can impact your professional identity. I was arguably a top performer and the C-suite before I was 40. And then I couldn't do my job. And I was like, now who am I? Like, I am no longer a C-suite executive. I no longer have a job. I have no salary. I was like completely flattened by that. And I had to re sort of think about my identity, and my job is only one part of my, because prior to that, my job was the most important part of my identity. It was more important than any other role that I played because I had spent the most time doing that, right? My daughter was 5. I already spent 20 years in HR. Like, it was really important to me. And when you take out what, again, plug your thing in, when you take out that piece of identity and you're left saying, oh, now what do I do? You have to find a way back, or you have to adjust to that new normal. You don't always have to find a way back. I chose to really work hard to get back to the C-suite, but I had a lovely career as a consultant and other doing lots of other things during that time. I just felt like I had worked so hard to get to the C-suite. I wanted to get back to it.
I
But
wanted
again,
one of
it's
the
not
sorry.
all or nothing. Menopause doesn't happen to us, right? We get to choose. It does happen to us, but we get to choose how we move through it. And I don't want anybody to feel bad if they say, you know what? I had a great career and I don't want to be a C-suite executive anymore. This has just helped me to see that, right? There's no right or wrong to how you choose to move through menopause. And I think that that's one of the things that happens with social media. It's like this scare tactics, and it's this binary thing. It's like all loss or all liberation. And, you get to choose. You get to make your own path, and education and awareness and agency are going to help us to do that.
I do think, and I mean, for a lot of reasons, that's why I'm doing this podcast, right? Is to help people, help midlife women get unstuck. And some of that is helping people come to the realization that they actually even are stuck. Lots of people don't realize that. And then it's thinking about what are the things that you can control and that you can change and you can drive differently. And one of the aspects of this podcast is when I interview women, what I'm calling the midlife leaps, women in their 40s or 50s who make a really big change in their professional focus, their purpose, and have kind of reinvented who they are again with that idea of control and choice. And it isn't, is it menopause driven? No, but it's certainly amongst all these other changes that are going on at the same time, in our bodies, in our heads, in our hearts, in our lives, our relationships, our, financial prospects, whatever that is. So I love this idea of talking about identity and recognizing that your identity is often in flux, and it's very much a function of old tapes and stories you have told yourself, and can be a function of new stories you tell yourself about who you want to be and are willing to work hard to change to become.
So Thank you, because that is, you almost summarized the book that I wrote that is being published. So I wrote a book. Well, it's probably been a longer time coming than the last year, but I've been dedicated to it the last year and a half, and it is on identity. It's a memoir through the lens of identity theory. And one of the reasons I didn't want it to be a book about menopause for all the reasons that you just mentioned it. I want it to be relatable to a much broader audience, and there are so many books on menopause right now that the world did not need another one. And because of in my sort of theoretical, I wanted to turn my dissertation into a book, but it just didn't happen in 2016 when I finished my PhD. So using my PhD experience to help me write a book was really important to me. And I chose identity because my menopausal experience was such a disruptor to my identity. But again, lots of things disrupt identity. Any kind of loss can disrupt identity. And I think identity is not very well understood, that you can reformulate and redefine and reinvent your identity as many times as you want. There's a lot of misinformation about identities formed in adolescence, and then you hear people say, well, that's just who I am. And it's like, nope. That is not true. You have the opportunity whenever you want to rethink your identity. And identity is a big part of identity is a story, which is called, and I won't go too far into this, as it will be a bit off topic, but narrative identity is the story that we tell ourselves, and then we live into it. And sometimes we get so attached, and I'm sure in your work you see this a lot, we get so attached to our story that when the story doesn't go the way we think it's going to go, we don't even recognize that we're stuck. It's because we are stuck, but we're like, we don't recognize that we're stuck. It's like I'll use a friend who's been divorced now a long time, but it's really her story was she was going to be married ha happily ever after, and that they were going to raise their family together, and she's been single now for a long time. And she can't, every time she's in a relationship like that, she cannot let go of that. Like, she has to rewrite that story. She has to unstick herself from that story to free herself. And that's just like one example. It's like women who struggle to have kids and they can't rewrite that story, that narrative, if they're unable to, or your significant other passes away much younger than you expect, and you're like, your life is over. And it's like you need the tools and the understanding that you can rewrite. And identity is layered and complex, and narrative identity is just one part of it. But you get to rewrite the story. So that's sort of what my book's about, like the opportunity to redefine our identities when our story no longer holds us.
Oh, I love that. And I know, as you said, I do a lot of this kind of work with my clients. And honestly, some of it, my organizing clients, we're talking a lot about identity because it's so connected to the stuff we own. It reinforces the narrative we're telling ourselves about who we are. And then it's a ton of it in the career coaching side. And when I'm working with people on resumes and I interview people and I hear their story. They don't even know the story they're telling me. And I'm saying, I need you to hear what I'm hearing. And is this who you believe you are? Is this what you're putting out? Because I actually hear your fact pattern in a different way. And I'd like to give you this idea. As an example, I was speaking with somebody recently who very much minimizing and downplaying impact and right, lots of reasons why it, but mentioned that they'd rolled out something in, well, it was only 120 countries. And, it was just when I said, whoa, hold on. Do you know how many countries there are? Like 120 countries is like almost all of them, right? Like that's huge. But interestingly, this person really in their mind was downplaying the impact of what that is and didn't realize that that's how their story that they were telling themselves and again through resume and interviewing that it was coming out. And that's why I have that same kind of passion to help people understand what it is around their identity and their story because how they tell it and how they live it is part of getting unstuck.
Yes, and there's this whole body of literature on like possible selves that's really interesting, that is really helpful for people to see that they can explore the possibilities and try things on. And if they don't fit, then they can let them go. And that's like, I think from a coaching perspective, really interesting to not be like, if this story doesn't work, then I'm doomed. And I believe me, I understand that. It was a lot of work to program my identity. And so I hope that people can see themselves in the different identity, the different versions of identity that happen over a lifetime, and that it is an invitation to choose who you want to become. And again, I do not want to make anybody feel bad who says, you know what, I'm perfectly happy the way I am, and stuck or unstuck. But if you are stuck and you can't find a way forward, there are all these paths to take. And if you want to do something in the middle, and if you want to just reinvent yourself to your new normal, like that's okay too. Like there's so many options, and I feel like we don't often see them because we're on the treadmill or on the conveyor belt of like what we think is supposed to happen next, right? We're going to get the next promotion, or we're going to do the next thing, and our kids are going to launch, or our husband's going to, and like life just doesn't always happen that orderly.
It doesn't. And this is a good
No.
segue into the quicksand three, the questions I ask all of my guests that really based on what this podcast is all about, because one of them is really about imagining other possibility, right? Which is if money and skill and time and history and geography and all that were not an issue, is there another career or job you would have liked to have tried?
I would have liked to be a librarian.
That's fun.
And I love the complexity of it. I love books. I love that kind of peaceful environment. But growing up in a lower middle class, blue collar family, I felt like I had to make money. And a librarian didn't feel like it hadn't, it felt like a very respectable career, but not one with an upward trajectory per se, not one that was like gonna satisfy that capitalism achievement orientation that I felt like that like I wanted to get out of sort of the background, like the confines of my lower middle class background. And I didn't see, and I think I was probably incorrect in that assumption. Back then I felt like the only way was to get into business, right? Like get out of the work that my family was doing and do something that was different and that was going to put me on a path. And I've thought about going back to it, but it is super complicated to become a librarian, like library science and technology. And here in Portland, the libraries are like social service centers. So there's a whole level of counseling and things that comes along with being a librarian that is different than I imagined it back, when I was a kid. But that's the one thing that comes to mind,
Love it.
librarian,
I love it.
the career that could have
I love
been.
it. Good. Next one. What is a way, a tip or technique that you use to get yourself unstuck and motivated to do something you've been avoiding?
So there's two things. And when you were talking about unsticking, I don't want to answer a question with a question. So I'll answer it and then you can reflect back. Acupuncture is like incredible for unsticking. That's like a master unsticking though. That's like when you're like that when you're stuck with the trauma and what all the stuff in your body. I felt like acupuncture is what rescued me. Like it got the energy moving through my body, and I think we don't realize how important that is. That we don't even, again, you said people don't even know what's happening. Like that's like your body is like stuck. You can't move the energy, so you can't move yourself forward. Like, so I find acupuncture to be amazing. But in terms of like, that's like meta. In terms of like day to day, boy, reinventing myself as a writer, I've found myself stuck a lot. And so unsticking from that is usually just walking away and letting my brain rest. And it's amazing what rests on, like, on your like I wake up the next morning, if I go to sleep thinking about that problem, the next morning I can probably write 300 words in a half an hour when the day before I only wrote 2 words. And I know it's hard to walk away because I was a compulsive person myself as an executive, and I couldn't leave until every email was answered and every to-do was checked off my list. But if there's anything I've learned about being unsticking myself. It's just like walking away, even if it's for 15 minutes and taking a walk or going to make a cup of tea, or if it's later in the day and it is bedtime, going to take a bath and just like letting it go and putting it out to the universe. And then the next morning be like, oh, now I know what to do. It's amazing how our brains work.
I feel that way. This is silly, but doing the New York Times crossword puzzle sometimes, I like to do it at night. It comes out of 10, and I'm like, I can't get this. And then I'll go to sleep, and I'll wake up in the morning. I'm like, how did I not see that word? How did I not see that word last night? Obviously, it's this, but like fresh brain, it's all clear.
Isn't it crazy? Your brain does work while you're sleeping. I mean, I don't know a lot about brains. Maybe I would will spend some more time learning about them, but it's fascinating. It's been fascinating to me. And I think it probably was always like that, but my problems were rather routine as a CPO. So like I kind of knew what I had to do a lot of the time, until COVID hit, of course. And none of us knew what to do. But that wasn't really stuck. We weren't really stuck. We were more like just panicked. But yeah, I think just letting yourself let go, and going to do whatever it is that makes you enables you to take a break, whether that's a walk or putting on a podcast or dancing in your kitchen. It's like just walk away. Again, even if it's for 15 minutes, because you really feel like you have to get that thing done. But if you can sleep on it, boy, the brain is pretty miraculous.
That's true, and that's why sleep hygiene is even more important than ever. Thank you so much for spending your time with me.
Can we teach younger people about sleep hygiene? Because
Oh
I didn't learn
gosh,
it. I
I
didn't learn
hope
it.
so. I hope
I
so.
don't. It is crazy how important sleep hygiene is, and I think I've only learned it in the last 2 years.
Way too late, and I'm still working on it. Thank you so much for being here. I want to listen, there are going to be people who are listening today, and again, I think some HR people, but in general, people who are in the workplace saying, I think my company needs to hear more about that. How should people get in touch with you if they want to have a conversation?
I have a website, which is my name, susanmealy.com. And so that has all my info, contact info, some of my writing, and my workshops that I give. So that's the
Okay,
easiest way.
great. And I heard you mention that you have a Substack. Is that can we find it on there too?
Yes, and that is also susanmealy.com. And I
Perfect.
do post a lot on LinkedIn, but the algorithm is beyond my comprehension, who I reach and who I don't reach.
It's all a mystery. It's all a mystery. Good. Thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate the work that you're doing, and I know that workplaces and people in their daily business lives are benefiting from the conversations you're leading.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You can see that Susan's very passionate about this concept and making change in the workplace and working with leaders and coming into organizations to just normalize having a conversation about menopause. And it's crazy, right? Have so many people will experience it. So many of our colleagues will be experiencing it. It's going to be a part of our lives and our workplace culture, but we still don't talk about it. Forget about building it into benefits and policies and practices. I hope today kind of got you thinking a little bit about what your company is doing or could do, and maybe even inspired you to go have a conversation with HR, or if you're in HR, to have a conversation with your leadership about different ways to be normalizing this conversation about menopause and focusing on why it's an inclusion and a workplace culture conversation we can't afford to not have.